my allegiance, and I think the allegiance of the church, is to God. First, second, third, last. It is not to any political structure.
Welcome to Dangerous Dogma, the authority on questioning authority. I'm Brian Kaler, president of Word and Way. You can learn more about us at wordandway.org. In this episode, we're going to have a conversation with Michael Livingston. He's the interim senior minister at the Riverside Church in New York City. As we'll be talking about in the interview, this is a church with a rich history on a lot of really significant areas in religious and political life. So I was excited to be able to have this conversation about what is it like to be leading this congregation today, as well as to remember some of those important moments of the past. We also talk about some of his other ministry experience, such as his time with Interfaith Worker Justice in Washington, D.C., and with the National Council of Churches. So I think you'll enjoy this conversation as we cover these interesting and different areas of ministry and reflect on what this meant in the past and what it might mean for us today and moving into the future as we think about ministry in this time that will hopefully soon be post-COVID. So here's my conversation with Michael Livingston at the Riverside Church in New York City. Well, Michael, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah, I'm really excited to have this conversation with you. And you have been involved with a number of historic and significant Christian ministries and organizations. And right up there with them is where you currently are as the interim senior minister for the Riverside Church in the city of New York. For our listeners who may not be familiar with Riverside, I mean, it's a significant church. When I visited New York several years ago, I made a point to go and visit. But I wonder if you give us a little bit of a background of what is Riverside Church for those that perhaps aren't familiar?
Well, as you've said, it's now a very historic congregation for reasons I'm sure will become clear if they aren't already to your listeners. It's a church with deep Baptist roots, but Riverside Church became Riverside Church in 1930 when this building was dedicated. And Harry Emerson Fosdick became the first pastor of this congregation. The church was actually built, financed by John Rockefeller. Rockefeller and Fosdick were good friends. And Rockefeller, wanted to support this great preacher that Rockefeller knew and admired, support his ministry. And to make that possible, this seems incredible at this day and age to think about this, but to make that possible, Rockefeller believed he needed to build this building, this really magnificent structure. Nothing else was working out in a way that would ensure Fosdick's being in a pulpit worthy of his abilities and gifts and the vision the two of them had for what a Christian ministry might look like on the Upper East West Side of Manhattan.
Well, you mentioned Fosdick, and I think it is a great place to start this conversation about Riverside, because before he was at Riverside, but this is, you know, perhaps a little bit of what you're alluding to. I mean, he's a significant preacher. He's, you know, well known, but he was also had some troubles at some other congregations before. And one of the things that got him in trouble was a sermon that he preached, perhaps his most well-known sermon, "Shall the Fundamentalist Win?" And I was thinking of that as we were preparing for this conversation, because we're coming up on the 100th anniversary of that sermon. So that was before Riverside was started, but that was part of his fame at the point that Rockefeller is partnering with him to start Riverside. You know, and I wonder if you've thought about this question that he posed a century ago, and as you look at our society today, you know, what might the answer to that question be of, you know, shall the fundamentalist win? Did the fundamentalist win?
It certainly appears as if they have won in some significant ways, especially as religion has folded into politics and we see some political expressions right at this very minute, the controversies going on in our society that are rooted in this divide between fundamentalist and more liberal Christian traditions and biblical traditions, because that's a good part of what they were about. But it does seem the fundamentalists in some ways have won. They're about to overturn Roe v. Wade on the Supreme Court. They have rolled back voter protections from civil rights legislation in the mid-60s. Some fear that gay marriage will be next on the agenda. These would be initiatives, movements, developments in liberal Christianity that have been targets for fundamentalists. And I hope that's not too strong to say about the conservative, the religious right, evangelicals today, but they would be hallmarks of what appear to be victories that are being won by the right. It's probably also needs to be said that some of the issues having to do with biblical illiteracy, having to do with inerrancy in the Bible, having to do with modern critical ways of accessing biblical the scriptures, Old and New Testament, those things are fairly well established throughout Christendom, certainly in the United States. But even there, you find rather large pockets of fundamentalists still operating.
Another, you know, key moment, and this was something that was actually just recognized at your congregation a month ago, last month, was the 55th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s famous sermon there at Riverside. It was exactly a year before he was killed, and this was his speech where he particularly took on the Vietnam War. And you all had a service to reread his words. And I wonder if you can talk about the significance of that moment in the life of this church as well. Because, you know, today, a lot of people like to quote Martin Luther King Jr., you know, pick some happy statements from I Have a Dream, and we won't judge people by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. And we often, it seems, like to gloss over, completely ignore the more radical side of King, which included not only then his strong critiques of racism, but also of capitalism and of war, of militarism. And he really leans into those in a prophetic way there at Riverside.
Yes. First thing I'd want to say is that speech, it's so much bigger than Riverside. This church as a location for the delivery of this speech is significant. And we are proud to say that it happened here. But that speech goes well beyond Riverside. It speaks to the nation. It speaks to the world, really, at a critical moment in the history, and especially having to do with this war that was being fought and which was dividing nations and dividing families here in the United States. And you're quite right. He talked about these triplets, these triplet evils of materialism, capitalism, of war and racism in a way, a powerful way that many regard as the greatest speech he gave in his entire ministry.
Because there was another moment that happened also on race, and I was thinking about this because it is a conversation that we're having a lot today, and that is on the topic of reparations. And this one, perhaps controversial in different ways than King's speech, but James Forman, actually a civil rights leader, interrupting a church service to read the Black Manifesto and to demand reparations. And I know that one didn't go over as well with some in the congregation, but it's still considered now one of those significant moments, particularly when you read through the document and think, you know, what if, you know, people had actually acted on the manifesto and some of the arguments? And here we are, you know, 55, 54 years later, still talking about occasionally, but mostly ignoring the topic of reparations.
Yes. Another critical moment. We just finished a series here with over 600 people participating in it. It was virtual, revisiting the question of reparations and looking at it from all sides. Still unresolved, that wound, racism, our coming to grips as a nation with our history of enslaving people and actually creating our foundational documents with full knowledge that we're engaging in this really horrific human behavior. And until we resolve this, and reparations is one of the ways that we can look at this, we're just not going to make the kind of progress we need to make as a society. A very powerful moment. We have people here, by the way, who were present when that happened and can tell you how they reacted. You see the range of reactions. Some who were abhorrent, they were watching, got up and left. Some who sat in stunned silence. Some who were more than curious, but even to some extent cheering this moment and applauding that this issue would be brought right down front in the chancel during a worship service.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that would be quite a moment of surprise, regardless of your opinion on the topic itself as an unplanned moment there in worship. I mean, there's so much more history that we could go through, and we're not going to spend time, you know, we haven't even talked yet about, you know, William Sloan Coffin. I mean, there's so many figures that have been significant there in the life of Riverside. And so I guess the question then, as you are shepherding this congregation, what is it like to be leading a church with this sort of rich, significant spiritual, cultural, and even political history?
It's a great honor for me. I'm privileged to be here for this time. I've been here 8 years now, 3 years in this role, probably not much longer. I'm certain within the year, perhaps even by the end of the year, they may have called a new senior minister. So I will look back on this time as a real treasure in my ministry. You see in the present congregation, the not remnants, but the vital presence of the streams that made this place historic. Really wonderful people, brilliant people, ordinary folks to professionals at the top of their fields. There's still this great and deep passion for social justice here. Almost every time someone joins, we hear this. I'm drawn to the social justice ministry of the church. So that tradition is alive and well here. And I can feel it. And I can feel it in response to not just my preaching, but guests that we bring in. We still try to use this pulpit as a place where great preaching can be done and heard and be the stuff from which members are nurtured and deepened in their faith, especially as the gospel calls us to encounter the society, to care for especially the most vulnerable among us. It's a great honor. It's been wonderful to be here.
But of course, you became interim in 2019, and I mean, I guess some things have happened in the time since then in the world. You know, much of your interim senior minister time period has been in this time of COVID, which has, of course, been a great stress on all parts of society, and pastors are not excluded from that. I wonder what's it been like as a pastor, as a minister, during these last 2 years of COVID?
Very difficult time. Fortunately for Riverside, we have resources that are not available to many congregations, but are present here. We were doing live stream worship services long before COVID hit, long before we were all forced into our homes by this terrible pandemic. So we already had in place the tools by which we could continue to live together as a congregation, though not in person from week to week, and in our meetings and in our governing structures. But we were already doing it, so we simply refined what we were doing and got even better at it, and have, I want to say, thrived in some ways. New communities, small communities within the church have been formed, because we've had to do it. There's a morning Bible study every morning with a devoted group of people anywhere from 20 to 30 people every day. We've done prayer and fasting through Advent and Lent on Friday mornings from sunrise to sunup. We've had vibrant adult education classes going on. We've had preachers from all over the country preach for us in this virtual format. So the difficulty has been making the shift from providing pastoral care in person to virtually. And that's a tough thing to do. People die and families need to gather to mourn. And that's a hard thing to negotiate in this environment. And it's caused great stress all around. But we've done the best we can to be present for our people and to continue to offer a full range of services, meeting the needs that exist among us. It's been challenging, but it's been rewarding as well.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm thinking about this, you know, a couple of months ago when we were hitting the 2-year anniversary of when, you know, things really shut down and the news was all about New York, right? I mean, you all were the first epicenter, if you will. And I live in the middle of Missouri. And while everything was shutting down in March and we're having all of these cases are spiking there in New York City, we weren't really having a lot. It was several months later. And then the Delta surge, particularly, that hit Missouri bad and hard, right? But it was a different waves have hit different parts of the country. But in many ways, you all had to be there at that front edge when we knew very little about this virus. We didn't have a vaccine. We didn't have a lot of the resources and didn't have a lot of the knowledge that we have now. What were those early days like in the epicenter of trying to minister and to be virtually present as much as you could with the confusion, the concern, I'm sure the fear with many in the congregation?
New Yorkers took this pandemic deadly seriously. Because of the very conditions that you're talking about, it was the epicenter. It was the place where we could see in our own congregation and in our neighborhoods and communities in New York, people being profoundly affected by this, getting sick and ill, needing emergency services, the stresses and strains on the essential workers. And those workers were present among us in our congregation at every level. So we took it seriously. All these debates about masks and vaccinations when they became available, there were no debates here about it because we could see the dire effect that was happening all around us. So while it was tense and difficult and painful, everybody took it seriously and took the kind of precautions that were required to be as safe as possible. We stopped worship services in person immediately and went directly to virtual services. We shut the building down for everything other than our food service pantry. We kept making food available to people who needed it. We took the right kinds of precautions, social distancing and masks and protecting both those delivering these services as well as those receiving them from harm. But what choice did we have, right? People were getting sick and dying, and so we stepped right into that and did what we could to help. But New Yorkers took it seriously and rolled up our sleeves and comforted one another and volunteered and suffered together and tried to give one another hope as well.
I love the way that just so matter-of-factly you're like, well, what choice did we have? But, you know, I mean, unfortunately, we saw that a lot of people made a different choice. We saw the politics that were involved in this pandemic. And, you know, I'm thinking about that history at Riverside of both pastors and guest speakers, you know, calling out societal ills. I wonder, you know, as you've watched our society at large, what has the last couple of years, what has this pandemic revealed about American society that is amiss? You know, what are the social ills today that perhaps we knew about them and leaders at Riverside have been calling them out, but what is even more, should be even more obvious to us today?
first thing that comes to mind to me are the myth that we've made more racial progress than we have, that we've made great strides, that we've solved the racial divide. That just isn't the case, and you could see it in this, the disparate levels of impact on communities of color. I'm including here not just African Americans, but brown and Latinx, Hispanic, Asian, the Native American communities, all hit terribly hard by this. We're not finished with the question of race. We still have to deal with that. And then related but different would be the great divide in income, the wealth disparities from the wealthy and all the rest of us, really. The rich got richer, some of them, in this. Corporations, some of them, their profits swelled during this. But ordinary folks and even middle-income folks have suffered in this. So the income disparities, the haves and the have-nots, the 1% and everybody else, those divides are still there. And I would just say the structural implications for both of these things, in race as well as economics, our government, our policies, our typical practices protect and favor, benefit the wealthy, the privileged, white folks still, to say that part of it plainly. And so we have structural, systemic work to do in order to change these kinds of circumstances. And then I guess, I'm not sure why I want to mention violence. Maybe it's not peculiar to the pandemic, but because of the great strains that we've all been under and some of the racist implications which Trump labeled on the pandemic, we've seen the rise in Asian hate here and just violence. Right in the middle of this pandemic, the killings of Black men and women by police officers. There are just so many deeply divisive and painful things going on that we haven't yet addressed nearly as adequately as we should.
Yeah, I mean, you just hit King's three-pronged ills right there all over again. I mean, in some ways we have made progress and we don't want to discount that, but in so many ways we still need that word on all three fronts. So, you know, one of the things that we often hear, particularly in conservative parts of the country and middle of America, I don't know if you know this, but sometimes we'll talk about New York and it's usually not positive, right? You know, when we talk about faith, we talk about, you know, secularization and the, you know, the godless city, and New York is always at the top of that list. And so, I mean, here you are, I'm not going to suggest that you're, you know, ministering in the, you know, the belly of the beast here, but like, what's it really like? Because, I mean, you're talking about, here is a vibrant faith community for decades planted right there in the heart of the city. We can hear some of the city noises in the background as we're having this conversation. You know, what's it really like ministering in a large city like New York?
You have to get used to the subways and the buses and pounding the pavements. So it's, of course, there's some real differences. There's Broadway, right? And major sports teams of every type all around. And there are all sorts of pleasures, distractions, opportunities for engagement that could take people away from deep profession of their faith. But these things exist together, and they don't mutually exclude one another. So you find people in the Riverside Church and in many, many, many other churches here in New York City whose need for community, religious community, faith community, whose need for Bible study and Sunday worship and hymn singing is as present and real as it is for people in Missouri or anywhere else in the country. It just takes place in the city that never sleeps, right? But the basic realities are still there. we get wounded and we get hurt. We suffer loss. These are basic human emotions. It's the human condition. And no matter where you are in the country, none of us escape these existential realities. And church is one of the places where we're helped to deal with that. And that's no different here than anywhere. We're just doing it in a place that's, I'm looking out the window at the Hudson River and the George Washington Bridge now. And as you say, we're hearing the sounds of the city as rush hour is upon us. But that doesn't mean you don't need a pastor to pray for you when your mother is sick and ill, or you've lost someone to COVID, or any of the other ways that life intrudes on us. Death rears its ugly head, depression, all of that is here. We've got to deal with it. Being in New York City, it's almost irrelevant in some ways.
So as we look more to the future, I mean, we're not out of the pandemic yet. COVID is, we're between waves. Hopefully we won't see more significant waves like we've seen in the past, but there's still people dying. As the point that we are talking today, they've estimated now that we've officially topped the 1 million mark of people who have died from COVID in the United States. So it is still ongoing, although in many aspects, it seems our society has moved on. At some point, we're going to come back to a new normal of sorts, probably not the old normal. What do you think that this new normal means for churches? Not just Riverside, but what does this mean for Christians, for pastors, as we move forward, as we're noticing that, some of those people that used to sit in the pews, maybe they checked out the last 2 years and they're not coming back to church. What does this mean for us moving forward?
We have to work especially hard to continue to stay connected to people, whether they come back in our building or not. We have to take building beloved community as seriously as we did before the pandemic. And we have to expand our ability to use whatever means are available to us to keep building that community, to keep the connections alive among us. We can't turn inward on only those who return to our buildings now. We have to still find ways to be in ministry, to be connected to people that may never come back. And there are people like that here at Riverside. There's some folks that just aren't going to come back again, and yet they want to be connected. We're going to lose some, that's certain, but we have to keep working to reach everybody who's out there, whether they come back to the building or not. So some of the things that we were doing are continuing. We've brought back some of the things that we stopped doing, and we're also doing some things trying to reach both communities, the virtual community and the in-person community. Our Sunday services now, there's always something in it that's recorded by someone who is in that virtual community, reading a scripture or doing something we call an invitation to give and serve, a little mini testimony on why I give, why Church Riverside is important to me. We find ways to make sure that that virtual community feels connected. Every week, our digital minister, we have a digital minister, reminds us, you got to look at the camera and make sure you're making eye contact with the 300 or 400 people who are watching online. So we have to accept that there won't be a return to church as it was, and we have to develop and exploit all the ways we can take advantage of the tools that make it possible for us to be community with what's ahead.
So I love that you have a digital minister. I want to clarify, this is a real person though, right? Not like you have a hologram or something that's just like showing up.
A real person. And get this, he lives in Michigan.
There we go.
Just before the pandemic, he and his wife got in a Airstream. I never knew what that was before you told me about it, but you do, don't you?
That's right. You see Airstreams in Missouri, probably not in New York City.
And he's driving around the country and he's connecting with people who are watching virtually. Now, this is before the pandemic. And then after roughly a year of that, his wife got pregnant. They settled in Michigan, where their families are from. And he's been our digital minister. Jim Keats, his name, since then. We see him every week on screen in our in our service.
Well, that's good. I think we might see that. I mean, in some ways, all pastors have become digital ministers, but it helps to have somebody who is particularly knowledgeable on that front. And so that's a great resource to have.
We'll be right back with the rest of this conversation. But first, I want to remind you that you should subscribe to Warden Way's award-winning e-newsletter, A Public Witness. It will help you make sense of the world of faith, culture, and politics. Learn more and subscribe today at publicwitness.wardenway.org. And now, back to our conversation.
I want to talk a little bit more about your ministry beyond just Riverside. Before you came to Riverside, you worked with Interfaith Worker Justice, and it's a great organization. And so I wanted to take an opportunity to introduce it a bit to our listeners. I wonder if you can tell us what you were doing at IWJ and, you know, the vision of this ministry that's still ongoing.
I was the National Public Policy Director and I ran the Washington office for Interfaith Worker Justice. So a lot that happens that affects workers, and the workers in this organization were mostly non-union workers. These are not folks who are working in union jobs with the AFL-CIO or SEIU or UFCW. These are workers, many of them were undocumented. So there are issues, policy issues, that get decided in Washington, D.C. that affect working conditions, wages, even immigration law. So we needed a presence in Washington, D.C. to participate with other faith communities in their advocacy efforts, but also secular organizations who care about labor issues as well. We work with labor unions. We work with other faith traditions. We work with Bread for the World. We were in that mix of advocacy organizations trying to support legislation that helps workers, that protects their rights, that ensures safe working conditions and the ability to address issues that they encounter in their employment. So that's what I did for and with IWJ while I was there.
My contact that I've had getting to know people who worked with that organization in the past, not only having breakfasts to get clergy and union leaders together just to kind of cross these different worlds, but then also the encouragement for clergy to at Labor Day weekend to talk about labor issues.
Yes.
from the pulpit. I wonder if you can talk about why should churches care? Why should we be talking about, preaching about these sort of labor economic issues today? It's a softball question for you, but I'm going to throw that one out there for you.
Because our members are in these jobs that are affected by labor laws that discriminate against low-paid workers, underpaid workers, right? And we don't only care about our members, but also members of our community who may be unchurched. We do care. The gospel demands that we care about people, whatever their conditions are, and especially, again, people that are among the more vulnerable among us. So to care for people means more than praying for them. It means more than trying to get them into church and save their souls. It means trying to improve the material conditions under which they live so that they can enjoy the abundance of the earth that God intended for us all. Can't be Christian and not be engaged, I don't think, in work that addresses people who are poor, people who are oppressed, people who don't have the opportunities that many of us have. So that's why we do it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, most churches don't have a John Rockefeller sitting in the pew. And even those that do have a whole lot of other people who aren't independently wealthy and that really do need their living wage that is so rarely offered today for a lot of positions.
That's right.
You've also spent quite a bit of time with the National Council of Churches. And I mean, in some ways, you're still living into that kind of ecumenical role. As you alluded to earlier, Riverside Church is both affiliated with American Baptist Churches USA, but also United Church of Christ, and has been since its beginning. It is kind of dually aligned. But as president of the NCC and your work there, you know, you were particularly invested in this ecumenical movement. And so I wonder if you could talk about why is that a vision that's still needed? Because, I mean, in some ways, it seems like the heyday of the ecumenical movement in the United States has passed. It's not dead, and I hope it's not dead, but there doesn't seem to be as much energy behind this idea. But why are you someone who has invested your ministry in helping bring Christians together across denominational lines?
Jesus prayed that they may all be one. And scriptures abound with references to bringing people together, to crossing boundaries that divide and separate people, and that in our unity, even though there are differences among us, we are able to realize the beloved community that's envisioned in the Old and the New Testament. Churches are important in bearing witness to breaking down the barriers that exist among us. So some of the early work in the ecumenical movement was about moving some of those boundaries away from us and trying to reach agreement around things like the Eucharist, baptism. But also, and this was a part of the work that characterized my time there, it's not just these theological issues, but it's also church-dividing issues in society around the kind of issues that we've been talking about. Ecumenical has to mean more than trying to come to some agreement about the meaning of baptism. It also has to reach some kind of agreement about the way people, God's people, are treated in the world. So all those things were important to me and important to my denomination. I'm Presbyterian, actually. So I spent a lot of years working in the ecumenical environment, addressing those kinds of issues that divide us, including, by the way, why don't we add war to this as well? So it just keeps evolving, though. Mainstream churches are declining of every kind, and there's been more of a focus. It's broadened, actually, on interfaith beyond ecumenical. And I think you see more work going on in local communities, in cities like New York, and I hope in Missouri as well. It's not just ecumenical, but it's also interfaith. I hope that never dies, even though it doesn't have the kind of prominence today that it used to. These differences that have divided us historically from centuries ago, there's some significance to them, but they pale in comparison to the differences that divide us in the areas that we've been talking about. And we got to work on all of these things. And that's kind of where I think the ecumenical movement is going today.
Well, I love that you made that reference to being Presbyterian as you're serving at Riverside. And of course, you know, Fosdick was a Baptist who spent much of his ministry in Presbyterian churches. And so, you know, kind of history in the opposite direction, repeating itself there. And as a Baptist minister myself, you know, I'm thinking, all right, so you're Presbyterian, you're at this Baptist / UCC church. And, you know, you just made this comment about coming together on baptism. So, I mean, that seems like you've got it all wrapped up there as quite a, you know, a theological conundrum.
Oh, this is wild. So in my tradition, Presbyterians, right? It's either infant baptism, and an infant is less than 2 years old, or confirmation and adult baptism at 13, 14, 15. Riverside will baptize anybody at any age. And the first time I did a baptism, there's like a four-year-old kid. And do you pick him up and hold him and sprinkle him? Or what do you do with a three- or four-year-old? And it's just... And then, of course, I had never done a baptism by immersion in all my years of ministry before coming to Riverside. And here one day I was confronted with I knew it was coming, but I had to put those wading boots on.
I was going to ask and make sure you had the waders, because I'm afraid that a Presbyterian wouldn't be prepared.
I borrowed them. I don't have them. So it's quite a mix here. And that's taken some getting used to, but that's a part of exactly the thing I've been describing. These sorts of doctrinal issues that divide us at Riverside, to a large extent, they're kind of washed away. And it's not anything goes. It's all thoughtful and considered. But it's true that the focus isn't so much on how you do a thing and which particular theological slice is comfortable here. We try to make it work for everyone here, which I hope doesn't water it down too much. I mean, I'm not sure I'll ever get used to 4 and 5 year olds being baptized. Part of me is always going to say, well, wait a few years and let the kid make the decision on their own. And what's the rush? You're not getting baptized because we want your soul saved in case you die. That's not the point of it. That's not the meaning of it. But you know, you have to integrate. You have to accommodate. You have to accept that your truth doesn't have to be the truth.
I don't want to get you in trouble here, but I while we're on the topic, I mean, here you are bridging these different traditions. So I wonder if you can give us maybe let's pick on both sides. What's the thing that you're getting from the Baptist that you're like, I like that. The Presbyterians should try that, and vice versa. What's the thing that you're like, this is what we used to do in the Presbyterian church, and for some reason I can't do it here?
Yeah, you say you don't want to get me in trouble, right?
Well, you agreed to come on a podcast called Dangerous Dogma. I mean, you had to know that it was going to be risky.
Well, I'm frustrated that a lot of Baptists I'm encountering don't really understand what it means to be a congregational church. They don't fundamentally understand their own polity. And that's frustrating for me. And I think, and Riverside may be a little peculiar here because of its own history. I mean, I wouldn't want to say that all Baptist churches aren't like anything, but I'm not trying to say that. Riverside may be peculiar in this regard, but here, pastors, preachers are really valued for preaching. So you have in this pulpit Fosdick and Campbell and McCracken. These were extraordinary expositors of the gospel. Coffin and Forbes, these are princes of the pulpit before the first woman becomes pastor here. But in the polity, they're peripheral. And they're not here in the minds of lay leaders to really participate meaningfully in governance. And for me, coming from a Reformed tradition with the parity of laity and clergy participating fully in the governance of it, being essential to it in some ways, that's a little odd. But the pastoral role in this, I think, misunderstanding of congregational polity is greatly diminished, and you're kind of viewed as in the way. This is our thing, and you go over there and preach and get your name in the, and your face in the newspaper. And keep that. Let me stop now, but I'm getting in trouble here. I'll be gone soon. I guess it won't matter.
There you go.
So I wish for a better ordered and theologically rich understanding of governance here. That's what I would say.
As we've talked about your desire, your goal that we would work across these denominational lines, and we've also talked about the issue of militarism and war, you know, there's a debate that's been happening in a bit in the ecumenical community about the Russian invasion of Ukraine involving the World Council of Churches. There's been a number of people who have called for the WCC to suspend the membership of the Russian Orthodox Church because Patriarch Kirill has been such an advocate for the invasion, has justified the slaughter of Ukrainians. We wrote about this a little bit at our Substack newsletter, A Public Witness, and another former NCC leader, Michael Kinneman, talked to us for that piece. I mean, here's a man who has devoted his ministry to ecumenical work, but he also said that there comes that moment where we have to say through gritted teeth that we have to, you know, exclude a church from the fellowship because its teachings and actions constitute an egregious violation of authentic Christian witness. And I wonder, as someone else who has devoted a lot of time, energy, thought to this topic, whether you want to tackle the Russian Orthodox Church specifically or just this broader question, when do we come to a point where we have to say, no, not right now, you need to get your house in order before we can be in dialogue and cooperation together?
Well, church discipline is grace. It's essential. It doesn't mean there isn't love, but it celebrates community, and it celebrates unity, and it celebrates the protection of community and of the vulnerable. So I haven't been tuned into the WCC conversation. I've been reading on that. But let me give you a local example that is actually the reverse of this. So Ethiopia there's a war in Ethiopia, right? And the Tigrayan community in the north of Ethiopia has been under attack. It's a war. So there are atrocities on both sides. I'm not trying to pick sides here. But interesting part of Riverside's history in, I'll find the year for you in a minute, but I think it was maybe 84 when Coffin was here. No, is that Coffin may have left by then. But the Ethiopian Orthodox Church needed a home. Their numbers were growing. So they began worshiping here at Riverside. And this was during Coffin's time. So maybe it's the mid-70s I'm thinking about. And they had a home here. They grew, eventually became self-sustaining, were able to get their own church. I was approached about 2 months ago by Tigrayan Ethiopian Orthodox Christians who had been put out of their church by the Ethiopian majority. So the same divide that exists over there existed here. There were Tigrayans among the Ethiopian community, and they were living peaceably until this war. And they were then put out. So they came to me and said, can we worship at Riverside? And of course I said, yes, let's find a place. And they're here. Saturday, I just happened to go to their kind of a reception, officially inaugurating their time here. But these are hard decisions. I don't agree with the decision that the Ethiopians made to put them out of the church. So it's not a perfect analogy here. I'd have to think about the expulsion of the Russian Orthodox Church from the WCC. I promise, Brian, I'll give some thought to that. But wow, that we get to these places is quite something, and that a church will so identify itself with a governmental structure that is committing atrocities, that's a travesty. So I do understand where the WCC is coming from in this. Russian government is wrong here. Their aggression is ungodly. And that's just religious terms, and violating the sovereign border of another country. I mean, just in crass political terms, it's wrong. So I understand why the WCC might want to do this. And are you saying they have done it already?
No, there's their leadership is not, but there's some significant religious leaders within the community are encouraging the action to happen this summer, perhaps. But you know what, the example that you just gave, I mean, so you've got, I mean, this all comes down to nationalism, right? So we have we have this conflict, and it divides the church in New York. We have the Russian Orthodox Church that is nationalistically siding with its government as it's invading and slaughtering Ukrainians. And we're dealing with Christian nationalism here in the United States as well. We saw it most notably on January 6th. But I mean, it from all three of these examples, it seems to be pretty obvious that nationalism is a serious threat to the unity and the witness of the church.
It absolutely is. I have never been in a church that continued, if it did when I got there, display an American flag in the sanctuary. I remember one church I visited. This was a Baptist church. You walk into the sanctuary, there's a picture of Jesus on the back of the chancel and a picture of the pastor. An American flag. These things don't work for me in quite this way. And my allegiance, and I think the allegiance of the church, is to God. First, second, third, last. It is not to any political structure. And in a minute, I will choose the values of the gospel over national priorities. When those practices, when those laws violate basic Christian values, as I understand them and as I read them in the gospel. That's not even a choice for me. My allegiance is to Jesus Christ, is to God, not to the flag. When I know what that flag stands for, it's not the Confederate flag. In some ways, it's as challenged and as bloody as the Confederate flag, though. Slavery is in the Constitution, not the word, but the institution. It's going to be there forever. You can add all the amendments you want, but we know in that founding document, women, white men without property, Native Americans, and enslaved Africans are second-class citizens, if citizens at all. And we have to come to terms with that. And we haven't.
Well, I think that's such a great word, and it's a good place to close our conversation. Michael, thank you so much for taking time to be with us. I appreciate so much what you had to say and just your ministry, both its witness over these years and as you talk about it with us today. Really appreciate it. So thanks for joining us on the podcast.
You're very welcome, Brian. It's good to meet you. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you and with your listeners.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Dangerous Dogma. You can find more information and links in the show notes at dogma.wordandway.org. And don't forget to check out our website, wordandway.org, to learn more about our other offerings, including A Public Witness, a subscriber e-newsletter to help you make sense of faith, culture, and politics. If you've enjoyed this episode, I hope that you will share it with your friends on Facebook and head over to iTunes or your favorite podcast platform and write a positive review. It really will help more people to find the show. If you'd like to give to support this program, we greatly appreciate it. And all you have to do at wordandway.org is hit the donate button. And whatever you give there will help support the production of this podcast, as well as our website, monthly magazine, and other offerings. If you have any comments or feedback about this program, you can send those to me at bkaylor@wordandway.org. Thanks for listening.